Beste mensen, beste luisteraars, ik doe even een kleine huishoudelijke mededeling. Mocht je deze show belangrijk vinden en mocht je denken, ik draag het een warm hart toe, ik wil dat het blijft voortbestaan, weet dat ik alle steun heel erg hard kan gebruiken. Voor de mensen die deze maand mij hebben gesteund, die mensen wil ik heel erg bedanken bij deze, via deze weg. En mocht je ook willen steunen, zet de video nog even pauze. Linkjes vind je onder in de beschrijving. Patreon en petje af. En mijn dank kan niet groter zijn. Nou, en zonder nu verder nog te vertragen, wil ik de gast van vandaag aankondigen. Een hele bijzondere gast, namelijk niemand meer of minder dan Alex Stein. How did I pronounce it?
Alex Stein.
Stein. I'm here with Alex Stein.
You can say a tour guide, educator, translator, editor and founder of the Tel Aviv Review of Books.
Yes, and I know you because our mutual friend Dan, and we are here at his house.
Yeah,
and Dan is one of my best friends, and you're Dan's best friends as well, I guess. And so and we used to WhatsApp a lot, and have long WhatsApp conversations.
Yeah,
and always very very intense and good conversations. And you were actually the second ever guest of my podcast back in the day.
I remember during Corona.
Yeah, during Corona. Yeah. And we did an episode online with the webcam. And this is the first time we actually meet in person, isn't it?
It is. Finally.
Finally.
I think you look a little bit like Michael Fassbender.
Ah, really?
Has anyone said that to you before?
No.
I think you do a little bit.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
I think it's probably most people would say that's a good thing.
Okay, good.
I guess.
But you know, it's really great to finally meet each other. The timing couldn't be more perfect because I really want to talk to you about the situation in Israel right now. You are from Israel. You live there. And the last time we met, you also gave your background view on the situation back then in 2021, when there was also really big trouble.
Yeah.
And so now, now you are accidentally visiting Europe. And so I got a chance to finally meet you in person and ask you anything I want to ask.
Yeah.
So that's what brings us here, right?
Yeah, absolutely. That's the plan.
That's the plan. We were already talking a few minutes ago, and then you said, you have to ask a very good first question. And then you started to...
I gave you the first question.
You gave me the first
question.
Free
of charge.
Yeah, yeah. So can you repeat this first question?
You want me to ask the question to myself?
Yeah.
So
because it was a very good question.
So the question was... Now, I mean, obviously we're now 100 days. In fact, yesterday we marked 100 days since the start of the current war. And it's appropriate we're in Holland because earlier this last week, the case in The Hague for provisional measures, South Africa's case against Israel, accusing it of genocide and incitement to genocide, was held. And in Gaza, the total number of people who have been killed is around 23,000, 24,000, of whom I would say probably, let's say somewhere at least between 5,000 and 10,000 would have been combatants. But again, it's hard to know exactly what that figure is because those figures aren't released by Hamas, who runs Gaza. And Israeli support for that war, and there was another protest in Amsterdam and in London and in lots of places across the world calling for a ceasefire. And we'll get into, I think, the meaning of what is meant when people say ceasefire in this context. But Israeli support, particularly, I would say, mainly Israeli Jewish support, okay? Israel is 80% Jewish, 20% Arab, what gets called Israeli Arabs or Palestinian citizens of Israel. But definitely Israeli Jewish support for Israel is Israeli Jewish support for the war is extremely high. You know, close to, I would probably say 99%. There might be differences of opinion about certainly about how the war should be conducted. And there might be differences of opinion about the question of the hostages. And there might be differences of opinion about the day after. But in terms of the basic agreement that Israel should continue to fight this war with the aim of destroying Hamas in the Gaza Strip, there's widespread support. And I'm not naive. For a lot of people, they don't understand that. They don't understand how one can support that. They find that unconscionable. Whereas I believe it is the right thing to support. I believe it is morally correct as well. And I think I should start by explaining that. And then we can get into other issues. All right. So we have to go back to, obviously, to the beginning. I think in our first podcast, we talked about the difficulty of talking about a beginning, right? Because anyone can choose a starting point, particularly with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, 1948 or 1921 or 1881, or we could go back centuries before, we could go back. So there's all kinds of issues, but definitely October 7th undoubtedly marked a new phase in the conflict between Israelis and Palestinians, with Hamas's attack on Israel. And lots of people have used different words to describe what happened on October 7th when Hamas attacked Israel, murdering around 1,200 people, the vast majority of whom were civilians. And some people call it a pogrom, bringing to mind massacres of Jews in Europe. Or some people call it just a massacre or a slaughter, whatever. But I think it's misleading. I think these words aren't helpful. I think the most accurate word to describe what happened was invasion. It was a Hamas invasion of Israel from territory that Israel had withdrawn from in 2005. If you like, it was a sort of sneak preview of what would happen if Israel was to lose a war. Okay, what would happen if Israel was to lose a war? The Egyptian dissident writer Hussein Abu Bakr said, anyone who is honest and telling the truth and who grew up in the Arab world knows that October the 7th is how we were taught the liberation of Palestine would look like. And this was confirmed by the reactions to October 7th, even in the immediate days following. In other words, even before the 24 hours following, before many Palestinians had been killed, which said things like, this is liberation, this is what decolonization looks like, this is all Israel's fault, etc., etc. In other words, the things that it confirmed our worst fears, and that's across the political spectrum. Okay, from certainly across the sort of Zionist political spectrum in Israeli life, which is the vast majority of Israelis, from the right, but even over to the left and the center left. And one of the reasons for that is that many of the people killed and murdered, disproportionate numbers of them, came from the sort of center left or even far left in one or two cases of the political map. And it was a reminder of the danger that Israel faces. In other words, for one terrible day, we experienced what other minorities in the Middle East experience and have experienced, like the Yazidis or the Chaldeans or the Kurds and the Copts. All of these groups, these non-Muslim, particularly non-Sunni Muslim groups, and obviously Kurds are Sunni Muslim, but they're not Arabs, have faced over in the Middle East, which is dominated mainly by Sunni Muslims and in some places the Shia. And this was a big wake-up call. Now, of course, one of the reasons so many were killed is because we fucked up. And we fucked up big time. I'm allowed to swear?
Of course. Yeah.
Okay. We fucked up
big
time.
If you want,
time.
I can say bleep.
Swear words are sometimes very important. And we fucked up on an intelligence level, in terms of the army getting in to help people. People were completely helpless. In other words, the idea of Israel is that Jews should never be helpless. But for that day, people were completely helpless, alone in their safe room, no one coming to help them, their houses burnt down, shot, etc., etc. So it was really, it was that for on the Israeli side, it was the single deadliest day in the entirety of the conflict. And one friend of mine, I remember, said, again, someone who's quite centrist, I'd say, politically, I remember saying, how can you respond to this if not with violence? And it's a very uncomfortable thing to face. It's a very uncomfortable reality to face the possibility that there only could have been some kind of a violent response. Okay? In other words, and I think one of the reasons people misunderstand that, particularly in Europe, is because they understood it, they understood what happened as a sort of one-off terror attack, kind of like what had happened in Paris or London or in Manchester in the last sort of decade or so, rather than an invasion and the realization of an ideology that is not motivated primarily by, that is not driven primarily by the fact that many millions of Palestinians live under Israeli occupation. Although, of course, that exacerbates the problem, and of course that needs to be dealt with. But the main reason was the fact that Israel exists in any shape or form as a Jewish state in the Middle East. That is the main issue. And all of the other problems, such as the Israeli occupation of the West Bank, or even the problems faced by Gaza prior to October the 7th, are symptoms of that problem. And if what you do is you only treat the symptoms, then you're not going to deal with the problem at all. So that was the situation, I think. That's the sort of immediate feeling after October 7th.
October the 7th, you say, is like a sneak preview of what will happen.
Yeah.
Can you work that out a little bit?
Right. So fundamentally, Hamas and Hezbollah, and now the Houthis, are devoted, led by Iran, orchestrated by Iran, are devoted to Israel's destruction. When they mean Israel's destruction, they definitely don't mean creating a sort of great democratic, bilingual, binational country, roughly similar to, let's say, Belgium. Okay, that is not what they mean. We know that's not what they mean because there is no country like that in the Middle East. And we know that's what they mean because of the things they say. And if we look at it's interesting and it's ironic because one of the charges Israel faces, have faced this week in The Hague, is incitement to genocide. Because many Israeli leaders said in the aftermath of October 7th and continue to say appalling things, things that I would absolutely disavow, calling for mass violence, calling for acts that could be considered genocide on the Palestinian population. However, the Iranians or groups connected to the Iranians and Hamas and Hezbollah and the Houthis, whose literal slogan is "Cursed be the Jews." Okay, one of their slogans is "Cursed be the Jews." Have been doing the same and worse for years and years and years, only for us to be told, oh, they don't mean it. Oh, it's just because you're occupying the West Bank. Oh, X and Y, X and Y. But they do mean it. And we know they mean it because the empirical evidence is very clear.
And how do you know they mean it?
Right. Well, we haven't...
I think it's a good question to ask yourself, right?
Okay. Well, we know they mean it because whenever they have the opportunity to do so, they do it. So the example is Israel. Let's look at when Israel has withdrawn from territory. Okay, there have been two major withdrawals in recent years. Israel withdrew from South Lebanon in 1999 unilaterally, which was a mistake to do so unilaterally. Today, there's a dispute over an area called, we call it Hardov. And the Lebanese call it the Sheba Farms. We won't go into the details of that dispute, but it's a small land dispute over whether it's Lebanese or Israeli or Syrian. Okay, lots of countries around the world have these small land disputes, but that has been used as an excuse for Hezbollah to entrench itself in Lebanese life and to, with the help of Iran, to amass thousands of of rockets, much more sophisticated weaponry than anything Hamas have. And the reason they do that is because they're devoted to Israel's destruction. Now, at the same time, they're not idiots. In other words, they realize that they're not capable of destroying Israel right now. Okay, they're not that's not something they're capable of doing, but they are capable of causing it tremendous trouble. They are capable right now. Thousands of Israelis from the north and have been forced to leave their homes because of the threat of Hezbollah rockets. And Hamas, the same story. Israel withdrew from Gaza in 2005. Israelis, the formula was always land for peace. The formula was always that if Israel withdraws from territory, that will bring peace. That was the idea. The main Israeli concern, the main reason most Israelis have been reluctant to leave territory is not because of a great commitment to staying in the West Bank and this sort of these ancient Jewish heartlands, although that population group exists and is relatively strong, but they're not the majority. The main reason is because they're worried about what will happen the day after. They look at South Lebanon. Before October 7th, they looked at South Lebanon and they said, we left Lebanon and they still have Hezbollah there who are devoted to our destruction. We left Gaza in 2005, again unilaterally, again imperfectly, again not in order to solve, to make peace with the Palestinians, but still this was the largest piece of territory the Palestinians had ever liberated, quote unquote, from Israel. And by 2007, Hamas had taken over and ever since then have used it as a basically turned the territory into a sort of vast military base with which to attack Israel. And on October the 7th, they carried out their invasion, their mass murder and rape and torture. And then they've said, we will do it again and again and again. And that is why we know they will do it. And that is why Israelis of all stripes really believe that the time has come to try to put an end to it, even with all of the difficulties that entails.
And that's why the support is still 99% in favor of the...
That's my rough estimation, okay? it's very, very high.
Even if it's rough, it's still the numbers speak for themselves, right? Yeah.
There's a small anti-war. There's a small sort of anti-war demonstrations take place. But the vast majority of Israeli Jews...
But in the mainstream Western output of media, we see a very strong voice. I think the majority is in favor of a ceasefire or even to put an end to it. So how do you see that?
So how do I see it? Look, let's focus on the protesters. Okay, there were 200,000. There have been hundreds of thousands of people marching in London. Subscribe for a ceasefire. First of all, there's a lot of the people, and again, a significant chunk of those people are also people who don't think Israel should exist. There should be no Jewish state in any way, shape, or form in the Middle East. They see us as a Western colonial outpost, a sort of European outpost in the Middle East that destroyed the indigenous population to make way for our own society. And we should be replaced in one way or another. Again, there might be differences of opinion about that. But I'm also aware that lots of the protesters, there are many protesters who protest for a ceasefire because they are upset by the loss of life and the tremendous suffering that Palestinian civilians are going through in Gaza. And I totally understand that. Okay, I totally understand that. There's whatever one thinks of the situation, there is no doubt that there is tremendous suffering being caused to Palestinian civilians in Gaza. It's true that there are sort of sometimes Israelis, some of the things that have got Israel in trouble in The Hague are when Israeli figures say there are no innocents in Gaza. And by the way, that's missing the point, because to be a civilian, you don't have to be innocent, and you don't have to be some sort of idealized innocent, right? Like, to be a civilian, you could be a civilian and say, I support October the 7th. You could be a civilian and say, I hate the Jews. You could be a civilian and say, I hate the Arabs. That doesn't mean you're not a civilian. A civilian is simply someone who is a non-combatant. And it's right that international law takes measures to protect civilians. And it's understandable that people, even if they don't necessarily think that Israel should be destroyed in one way or another, are upset enough about the situation that they feel the least they can do is to march in favor of a ceasefire. That being said, I think they are fundamentally mistaken. First of all, because it is not a call for a ceasefire. A ceasefire is an agreement between the two parties to come to an end to hostilities temporarily or permanently. Whereas the protesters, they say ceasefire, but what they mean is they want Israel to stop attacking Gaza. There are no demands being made on Hamas, particularly with regards to over 100 hostages who remain in Gaza. This is completely absent from what they are arguing for. So we then have to consider what would be the implications of Israel saying, we've listened to the protesters and we are going to stop our attack. But I do acknowledge that the suffering of Palestinian civilians is greater significantly than the suffering of Israeli civilians, although I will say the suffering of Israeli civilians is greater since October 7th than sort of any time since, you know, we would say the Yom Kippur War, the Lebanon War, and this is unique because so many civilians were, of course, murdered in a single day. But I think the important thing is to understand what would be the implications if Israel said, we listen to the protesters, they're right, too much suffering, too much damage, we are going to stop attacking Gaza. And again, we have empirical evidence. We know what would happen because of what has happened in the past. We have had numerous rounds of fighting with Hamas in Gaza since 2007, again with far smaller casualty rates, but in each of those times the fighting ended, and in one occasion Yahya Sinwar, who is the sort of head of the military wing of Hamas, who is currently embedded presumably in a tunnel deep in Gaza, perhaps somewhere in the area of Khan Yunis, and probably surrounded by Israeli hostages as human shield. Once, in one of these rounds of fighting, he emerged and sat on a sofa amidst the rubble and declared victory. And he would say to himself, I can attack Israel. It's true that they will attack us and do a lot of damage, but I don't really care about my people dying because that's never been a particular concern of mine. Someone, the Qataris or the Emirates or the Saudis, someone will pay the bill for the rebuilding, and then we'll be able to do it all over again and we'll learn the lesson. This time we'll make sure that we're coordinated with Hezbollah, who will do the same in the north, and maybe we'll get our friends the Houthis to do the same. That is what would happen. That is what would happen. And the idea that there is any, that the idea that, that there would be some other alternative framework, at the very least, it is behoven on the people who are demanding a ceasefire to the very least articulate some sort of plan. Maybe it would be exile of the Hamas leaders, return of the hostages, whatever it might be, to articulate some sort of incentive to Israel that would make it in its interests to stop the war. But of course no one does that, because essentially, whether deliberately or otherwise, and I think that, I understand there are some very well-intentioned people amongst the protesters, in addition to the base which is devoted to Israel's destruction, but they are unwittingly doing Hamas's work for them. they are unwittingly doing Hamas's work for them. And it is important to understand that, that, you know, I don't know what will happen in the coming months, but we are unmoved by the protests. And I really believe when it comes to the idea of reconciliation between Israelis and Palestinians, I really believe the importance of honesty and telling the truth, even if whoever's listening finds it painful or upsetting. It's much better, right, than, you know, saying something they'd want to hear. We're unmoved by the protest. We don't feel that those people are in any position to judge us from a moral or political standpoint. And I think if there are ideas for removing Hamas from Gaza and ending their rule over Gaza, then people should step forward with those. But otherwise, the war, I think, will continue for the foreseeable future, albeit we're now into sort of stage three. Okay, there's already been a big withdrawal of forces, including members of my family who are in the army.
There are two things we should delve deeper into, I guess. The first thing is you mentioned that in these protests, there's this oversimplification of Israel being a settler colonial state. That's a critique I hear a lot these days. And although I immediately agree with your viewpoint, I think it still can be good to actually think it through why that isn't the case, right, and why it's oversimplification.
Okay, so I'm going to, first of all, one of my plans over the coming year, now that I'm not going to have any tourists, is to do some more teaching around the conflict. And I'm particularly interested in this set of colonial allegation. So the basic claim is that Israel is no different to Australia or to
America, or to South Africa, or
Canada, where white Europeans, to put it in simple terms, white Europeans come and take over a land that isn't theirs and ethnically cleanse the indigenous population. And while it is undoubtedly true that Jews dominated, at least at first, by Jews coming from Europe, Ashkenazi Jews, became a majority through a process of settlement over the course of the sort of early 20th century, culminating in the establishment of the State of Israel and what the Palestinians call the Nakba, the catastrophe, where 750,000 Palestinians were made refugees. While it is true, and there are certain parallels to the United States and to Australia, South Africa, in those basic facts, the most salient fact is completely different. And it's the most salient fact, and it is called a myth by people who accuse Israel of being a settler colonial state. And that is the fact that the Jews, do you know what Jew means?
What it means?
What does Jew mean? Do you know?
That's a good question.
I'm putting you on the spot. It's okay to say you don't know. Most people don't actually know.
Can I take a wild guess?
Go on.
I would guess it's something to do with the promised land. Like it's...
So it comes from Yahudi. Yahudi means someone from Judea. In other words, a Jew literally means a person from Judea. So there's already this weird talk in saying that Zionism about these white Europeans. There's already this tautology, right? Because how do they have this name Jew? How do they have this name Jew? And the reason we have the name Jew is because
the people from Judea are not from Judea. They are
Exactly. So our story, a lot of people claim that the story of the Jews is this kind of mysterious and very complicated and, you know, But at heart, the Jews are an ethnic group that originate from roughly the area of present-day Israel, Palestine, the West Bank area. And at a certain point in their history, in antiquity and late antiquity, they are in various waves leave their land. In some places they're exiled. In other places, there's just regular migration. And culminating in the first century, there was a Jewish revolt against the Romans. The Romans crushed that revolt. And from that point on, the Jews no longer controlled their ancestral homeland. They continued to live there in varying degrees for the next 2,000 years, but they no longer controlled their ancestral homeland, which was subsequently controlled by various empires. First of all, the Romans and the Byzantines, and then various Muslim, both Arab and Turkish empires. Until in the late 19th century, there was this movement called political Zionism, which sought to re-establish Jewish statehood in the ancient Jewish homeland. That is the defining difference between the South Africans and the Australians and the America and other countries. And it always presents a problem for people who accuse us of just being white Europeans. Okay, so how do they deal with this problem? They deal with this problem, I'm not going to mince my words, by lying. They deny the evidence, which is overwhelming. And I'm not talking about the Bible. I'm talking about the ancient synagogues. I'm talking about Hebrew inscriptions, religious paraphernalia, evidence of communal life, written texts, all kinds of things which demonstrate that this story is undoubtedly true. Or they say something like, the Jews are many of the Jews in Europe. And this is an idea that is still propagated by the Palestinian Authority, that the Jews are we're descendants of the Khazars, who are there's this story of this Central Asian Khanate in the sort of early Middle Ages that supposedly all of their population converted to Judaism. And we have no actual evidence of this mass conversion. It's a lie. Now, that's not to say that people wouldn't have converted to Judaism over the years. Okay, it's true that we don't encourage converts, but there would have been converts over the years. But again, that's our decision to welcome people into our community. It does not sort of invalidate the original story, or as I like to put it, it's the paper trail that counts, not the blood, not the genetics. Although if you do genetic tests of Ashkenazi Jews, you will find that they are a Middle Eastern people. So that is the most important difference. And the corollary of that is that the Palestinians they're not indigenous in the same sense as the Aborigines are indigenous. The Palestinians are a derivative imperial nation. Their identity, and by the way, the biggest proof of this is that, let's say, take Moroccan support for Palestinians, okay? We saw in the World Cup, there was great support and for Morocco and Palestinian support in Morocco and vice versa. And if the Palestinians are this indigenous group, okay, that have been the indigenous group of Palestine for thousands of years, how would it be that they have this deep relationship with the Moroccans or the Yemenites? The answer is the Moroccans and the Yemenites and the Palestinians are part of this derivative imperial nation of Arabs who came out of Arabia from the 7th century and conquered the Middle East, colonized the Middle East in one way or another, although it took on a different form to a lot of modern colonizations. That doesn't mean their presence in the land is illegitimate. It doesn't mean they shouldn't have the right to have a national homeland there. The Palestinians, in my opinion, and in the opinion of many other Israelis, should have the same national rights as we do. But we cannot have this lie that we are these illegitimate interlopers and they are just the descendants of the ancient population. My daughters would be able to read the inscriptions from 2,000 years ago better than a Palestinian kid. Right, so it makes no sense to say, and again, I emphasize again, I'm not saying that that Palestinian kid should have less rights as a result, but the land of, it is a tragic encounter between Israeli Jews and Arabs, Israelis and Palestinians in the lands of Israel. It is not a morality tale. It is a tragedy that when the Jews, when political Zionism was taking root, there was another people there. And obviously, for us to achieve our ambitions to create a national homeland, that was obviously one way or another going to cause tremendous suffering for the Palestinians. But we are now in the year 2023, and the basic principle has to be that both sides, that both Israelis and Palestinians, have a right to a national existence in the land of Israel, Palestine. We can then discuss the details. Is that two states? Is that, like, what does that mean? But that principle is not accepted. That the people who marched in Amsterdam yesterday don't accept that principle. The Houthis don't accept that principle. Hamas don't accept that principle. The current Israeli government doesn't accept that principle. Everyone who doesn't accept that principle, that is who has to be defeated. But the way you do that would take on different forms.
You said it's a tragedy. Yeah. And it's not a moral story, it's a tragic story.
Yeah.
So how do you define a tragedy? What's your definition of a tragedy?
Well, it's a tragedy because I think both Israelis and Palestinians are right. In the sense that the Palestinians are right that they were, leaving aside the whole question of indigeneity and things, the Palestinians are right in the sense that in the late 19th century, they constituted a majority of the people in the land that was Ottoman Palestine. And what happened in most parts of the world, almost everywhere, is that whoever was the majority in the certain land, in the with the fall of colonialism, were granted statehood. And in the Palestinian case, because of the Zionist movement, what some people call the settler colonial movement, we ended up with the War of Independence, what the Palestinians call the Nakba, conquering most of the land, 78% of the land, and that became the state of Israel. And so the Palestinians are right in the sense that it was their land and we took it from them. Okay. Yeah. But we're also right because it was our land, okay? It was our land as well. And that we have always maintained throughout our history a deep connection to the land of Israel as being not just the spiritual center, but the physical center of Jewish life. That's manifested itself differently in different times, okay? Sometimes it has been more of an abstract connection because Jews just weren't able to get there. At other times, it has manifested itself in waves of migration, even before the modern Zionist period. And that's why it's a tragedy, because the land should be, I do believe the land will have to be shared, because otherwise one of us is actually going to have to genocide or ethnically cleanse the other. And I wouldn't want to do that. And I wouldn't want that to happen to me. So we have to work out a way to share the land in one way or another. I don't see another. And this is realism. Okay. This isn't idealism. This is realism. Like, it's the realistic, it has to be the only realistic option.
So if I try to paraphrase what you said. Eh? So I asked you about this settler colonialism critique on Israel. And you said, no, it's actually, if you see it in a broader sense, if you take history, it's actually the other way around, because the Jews are the people from Judea. You can track it down. It's not only the Bible. It's in the,
even if we didn't have the Bible. I happen to think the Bible in a lot of these ways is a useful resource, particularly the later books of the Bible.
But wait a second. I try to paraphrase. Yeah. I have to concentrate a little. So the evidence is there. And the Palestinians what we call now Palestinians, these people, it's actually the people who colonized this land. But we don't call it colonizers because we acknowledge the fact that it's a tragedy where both of the people who are now there have a righteous claim to the land, and that's a tragic situation. Mm. So we have to find a way, because that's the only way, because that's what you do in a tragedy. That's what you say, right?
Yeah, I think there's one thing I would you haven't got me right. I wouldn't call the Palestinians colonizers. I said the Palestinians are a derivative imperial nation. Okay? In other words, somewhat akin to, let's say, countries and people in South America. They're clearly culturally descended, okay, from this 7th, 8th century wave of Islamic conquest. Now, there are Palestinians today say we are actually the descendants of the ancient Philistines or the Canaanites, to which I say, great, please start speaking Canaanite. In other words, you can't have it both ways. Okay, you can't be like, we're Palestinians, we're proud Arabs. Many of the most noble Palestinian families, the sort of upper class Palestinian families, proudly trace their heritage to Saudi Arabia. Okay, you can't on the one hand be like, we're very proud of our roots in Saudi Arabia, and on the other hand say we're the indigenous people of this land. Like it's like a clear contradiction. Now, if the Palestinians were to say tomorrow, you know, we are the native people of the land, but we weren't just colonized by Zionism, we were also colonized by the Arabs. So we're going to throw off all our chains of Arabness, and we're going to start speaking ancient Canaanite stuff. Then the story would be very different, and things would get really interesting.
Yeah, that's a very interesting perspective.
But they don't do that. In other words, they don't do that. They say, on the one hand, we're like the ancient people, you're the usurpers, but we're part of this wider Arab world. We're also part of the same nation as these people from Morocco who live thousands of miles away.
Yeah. And how do you look then at the claim of South Africa trying to call it a genocide?
There is the words change. Okay, Israel is accused of apartheid, or it's accused of ethnic cleansing, or it's accused of genocide. But really, what people want is to say Israel is evil. Israel is uniquely evil. Israel must be cast out of the family of nations. And that, before we talk about the specific allegations, that it's important to understand that is the aim. The aim is to say we have a country. It's to make Israel the Jew among the nations. We have this country that is uniquely evil and uniquely terrible and needs to be cast out. And the latest incarnation of this is the genocide claim. Now, the first thing we need to understand is that the South African president last week met with, I think, one of the Sudanese leaders who's responsible for an actual genocide in Darfur. So he's also not in a position to morally preach. I've managed to catch a lot of Israel's defense against the claims. Obviously, I'm very biased, but I thought Israel did a good job, particularly on the legal side. But the specifics are as follows. Number one, Israel is not trying to destroy the Palestinians. I accept that there is an all too significant chunk of Israelis or people in the Israeli or even some people in the Israeli government who would like to do that if they could. Okay, but being able to do something if you could, if that was a crime, then, you know, many people would be called to account for it. But it doesn't reflect the policy. And we know this because Israel waited, I think, sort of 2 or 3 weeks before launching its ground invasion, okay, during which time it repeatedly and incessantly told people to leave northern Gaza. Sun Tzu did not say, tell the enemy exactly where you are going to attack so they have time to be ready for it, okay? So if Israel was trying to eliminate the Palestinians, obviously it wouldn't have done that. And obviously, it wouldn't continue to try to take measures where it can to ameliorate civilian suffering. That being said, undoubtedly, the suffering of civilians has been on a scale unseen before in the conflict between Israelis and Palestinians. And the reasons for that are as follows. Number one, October the 7th was a unique event, the single deadliest day for Israelis in the history of the conflict. So obviously the response was going to break new ground. Now, Benjamin Netanyahu, our prime minister, who I am no fan of, and I can't wait for the day he is removed from office, but we have to give credit where it's due. In his autobiography, he writes that over the years, he often found pressure from people saying, we need to try and remove Hamas from power because they're too much of a threat. And he had resisted it. And one of the reasons he resisted it, because he said, number one, it's going to lead to huge casualties on our side, soldiers. Number two, it's going to mean thousands of casualties on their side because there's no way of doing it without that happening. And that's going to lead to tremendous pressure against us. But October 7th meant that we had to do that. So that's number one. Number two, Hamas transformed the entirety of almost the entirety of Gaza into their military base. And one of the best parts of Israel's defense was the issue of the hospitals and how almost every hospital in Gaza is used, has tunnels underneath or other military usage by Hamas. An obvious war crime. And obviously, while it's true, you shouldn't attack a hospital facility, that question changes if it's basically been turned into a military facility. So that's number two for the reason that civilian deaths have been so high. And number three is uniquely in this conflict, civilians have not been able to flee. In Syria, a million and a half people ended up just in Germany. I don't know the total facts, but huge numbers. Almost every recent conflict, people are able to flee. In this case, they are not. And the circumstances for that are quite unique. And it's important to understand them. Egypt does not want a single Gazan, even temporarily in like a field hospital in the Sinai, on its territory. Why? Because Egypt is a fairly impoverished and in some respects unstable country, and they fear that would destabilize it. But further afield, there is no pressure from anyone for, let's say, people to flee and become refugees, and that's because in the case of Gaza, the people are sort of, most of the population are refugees twice over, at least officially. In other words, the population of Gaza is just over 2 million. And I think around 3/4 of those are refugees or descendants of the refugees from 1948. And in the case of the Palestinians, uniquely, there is an organization called UNRWA, the United Nations Refugees and Works Agency, which exists for the Palestinians, and which defines a Palestinian refugee status in perpetuity, okay? Which is why the grandchildren or even the great-grandchildren of someone who was either expelled or fled their home in 1948 is in a refugee camp. These are now actually sort of inner city neighborhoods and are told they will one way return. The Palestinians say that the right of return is sacred. They say it's an inalienable right in international law, and they cite certain UN rulings to back this up. But it is, but that does not change the fact that it is not true. In the 1940s, millions of people around the world were expelled from their home or left their homes. Millions in India and Pakistan, the Sudetenland Germans, earlier you had Turks and Greeks, and you had, of course, the Jews, hundreds of thousands of Jews from the Middle East who left their homes and became citizens of new countries. Last week, it was my niece's bat mitzvah in London, and I sat with my the father of my sister's oldest friend, who was ethnically cleansed, essentially, from Bengal, from East Bengal, from the area of present-day Bangladesh, during partition, because he was a Hindu. He then went to Nigeria, and then he ended up in the United Kingdom, and he rebuilt his life. And that is what most people did. That's what my grandmother did when she left Germany soon after the rise of Hitler. That's what people all over the world have done. And the Palestinians uniquely have been unable to do that because their refugeehood is perpetuated because of the original cause of the problem, because it is perpetuated in order to be used as a weapon against Israel for two reasons. The Arab states use it as a sort of excuse. They can always point to how terrible Israel is, okay, as an excuse for the fact they're failing their own population, and because they don't want Israel to exist. And most of the radical elements in Palestinian society come from these refugee camps. And now you have this strange situation where people in the West wouldn't want Palestinians to be able to flee, because then they say, well, Israel wouldn't let them back. And that's a reasonable point to make. It's not an unreasonable point to make. However, it's the same point that could be made of the war in Syria. In other words, Assad also doesn't want the people who fled, who are presumably opposed his regime the most. He also wouldn't want them coming back. But no one would say, well, this is a reason we shouldn't allow them to be able to escape, to allow them to be able to seek a sanctuary elsewhere. But those are the three main reasons why the death count is so, the casualty rate is so high. None of those are because Israel is trying to commit genocide against the Palestinians.
The people who criticize Israel and people who are pro a ceasefire, they tend to describe Gaza as an open prison.
Mm.
Maybe you can say something about that?
Yeah. At best, they've said it was an open prison. At worst, they say it's like the Warsaw Ghetto. Even before the war, they sometimes made this claim.
I think even although I agree with what you just told me,
right,
I guess it's good to address this topic of this open prison topic, because I think people who tend to be on the pro-Palestinian side of this conflict, they really try to grasp this idea. Right. How do you see this situation? Okay. It's an open prison. It's like bombing a very small area, like two times the size of Texel. It's an island here. Right. It's a very small island.
Texel.
Yeah,
it's
people describe Gaza as like two times the size of Texel.
Right.
So if I'm in Texel and people say like, okay, there are bombs coming for Texel, I would be terrified, you know, because it's a very small island.
It's flat.
I can imagine it's a very it goes right into the imagination of people, you know.
Okay, so since 2007, when Hamas seized power in Gaza, taking over from Fatah, that in itself is an important story, but we won't go into those details now. Gaza has faced an Israeli-Egyptian blockade that has changed in intensity at various times. Now, the first thing to understand, it's been Israeli-Egyptian, okay? Because Gaza has a border with Israel on one side and Egypt on the other. But of course, if you were to do a Google search about the blockade of Gaza, it would take you a while to like remember that it has this border with Egypt, and Egypt is also part of this question. The second thing to understand is that Hamas are devoted, as we have said, in word and in practice, to Israel's destruction. And that in itself creates all kinds of dilemmas. How do you deal with that? And, you know, people have various ideas and various thoughts over the years of how you deal with that problem. But obviously, if you were living next door to someone who is devoted to your destruction, you would think about what you're going to try to let them obtain and have, you would think about, like, you would just be like, oh, here, I'm gonna let have all my Marmite and have all my yeah, you can borrow my lighter. You would, like, you would think about what you give them, if anything, and that has always been a dilemma for Israel. Third of all, this open prison, within this open prison, Hamas were able to carry out the October 7th attack, right? Another claim that we hear is that there's a one-state reality between the river and the sea. Max Weber said a state is an entity with a monopoly on violence. We obviously don't have the monopoly of violence, even if we are the obviously the much more powerful force. Hamas, I think the most, their budget was basically the size of Somalia. Now, Somalia is an incredibly poor country, but it's also a country, I think, of around 14 million people, right? And Gaza is just over 2 million. In the most recent times, Israel thought, and this was a big failure in our thinking, Israel thought that it's true that Hamas is devoted to our destruction, but they want to keep power. They're going to be pragmatic. We can come to an arrangement with them. And the arrangement was that more stuff would be able to get in, and more people would be able to get in and out. By the way, if you look over the years, there have been times when very few people have been able to leave Gaza, but there have been times when the numbers have been relatively high. And in the most recent years, Israel gave thousands of work permits to Gazans to come and work inside Israel. And we know now that many of those people who got those work permits gathered intelligence that was used in the October 7th attack. So that is why... So first of all, I don't think it has been an open air prison. It's been it's an entity which is definitely not a sovereign state, but it's definitely not fully occupied territory. That's another thing, by the way, when I talked about the words, people have said, even though Israel withdrew from Gaza, people have tried to argue it's still occupied. In doing so, redefining the definition of occupation, which normally includes, number one, boots on the ground, which obviously Israel didn't have, and it withdrew its settlements. Number two, the ability to control, at least the ability to fully control the territory, which Israel also didn't have after 2005. Or they cite the naval blockade. It's true Gaza's faced a naval blockade, which is an act of war. But if Gaza is occupied territory because of the Israeli naval blockade, then that means Israel is currently under a naval blockade from the Houthis. Okay? So I wouldn't accept that Gaza is occupied territory or an open air prison. I would say that Gaza is an autonomous territory that faces severe restrictions, most of which can be traced to the original problem. Okay? And that's not to say Israel has got it right. I think Israel has got its Gaza policy very wrong in the way it withdrew and since it withdrew. But the main source of Gaza's problems are the continuation of a policy that is committed to the destruction of the state of Israel. Because any policy that is committed to the destruction of the state of Israel will only eventually backfire on you.
Let's talk a little bit about the public reception of the conflict in the Western mainstream.
Yeah.
You mentioned hospitals in Gaza. Yeah. In the Netherlands, we had this absurd situation where the NOS, the news network of the Netherlands, they were really hesitant to cover the attack on 7 October. Like, there was a really big delay in the information flow. I was on Twitter and I saw it immediately, and then it took, half a day before the first things were published.
Right.
And that was really interesting. Because a week later, the coverage of the hospital that was being bombed in Gaza...
That had been bombed by Hamas.
By Hamas.
And we know now.
Well, but it was still in the news immediately.
Right.
After a few days, it came out that was basically Hamas propaganda. And what you said about hospitals, it's interesting that even the biggest news stations in the Western sphere act like this.
It's not my it's something that really people get really on both sides get really angry about, media bias.
Yeah.
It's sort of not, I have to admit, it's not my main interest. I sort of assume there'll be, you know, I obviously notice all kinds of ways in which language is sort of distorted and changed in both sides of the coin. And by the way, the Israeli media is extremely biased in another direction.
Doesn't it bother you that news coverage in Western media is so biased? Or is it something
you... I'll tell you the one thing that does bother me. I read The Guardian in the UK fairly regularly, so I see how they cover it. And I'm not surprised by any of the coverage. But the one aspect that does bother me is that you don't get a sense of what militarily what Israel is actually trying to do. If you were to read The Guardian, you would just think it's just sort of random acts of violence with no real purpose. Whereas if you follow the Israeli media, you really understand that there is a clear military strategy, and that military strategy isn't genocidal, but it is very difficult, and it's very hard to do it given the conditions in Gaza. But the strategy is to sort of basically go area to area, block to block, removing Hamas's military infrastructure to try to destroy as many tunnels as you can, which is extremely difficult because they've built so many kilometers of tunnels underneath Gaza, and to basically eliminate Hamas's power base. And that there's a plan for doing so. And you wouldn't get that, read me, you would just get a sense that it's random acts of violence. And look, similarly in Israel, the Israeli media isn't great at covering the suffering and what's happening to the people of Gaza. So it's definitely not a one-way street, but I think that's the biggest piece that I think is missing from Western coverage. And by the way, that's a broader point, because people aren't really interested. People just think of war as like, war is so silly and so dumb because you're like, everyone, you're just killing people. It's dumb. And that's true, because it is true that war is dumb, like having people kill each other. On the other hand, the fact that war continues to be a fixture of human life means that that having some sort of understanding of how it actually works and how militaries actually operate is kind of essential for understanding the world, right? But loads of really intelligent people who are otherwise very informed of global politics don't necessarily have even a basic understanding of militaries operate. By the way, I grasp maybe the basics. I was in the army, albeit for civil defense, not as a combat soldier. But that's a real problem, I think, in the coverage.
Yeah, and have you followed the controversy in Harvard and in the big universities in America? Yeah. What's your
again? Well, first take of all, thing that. I'd say, you know, I know these are things that get people. These are big social media issues, and they're big hot button issues in certain sectors. In Israel, it's you know, because we're facing the sort of existential aspects of this conflict, whereas these are the sort of the ripples of it, the subplots of the conflict. So in that sense, I find it hard to get really motivated in the same way. But of course, I followed what happened with Claudine Gay and all of that story. Look, I think there's obviously a significant but a sort of loud subsection of American universities who are basically foot soldiers of Hamas in the West. That was very clear after October 7th. I suspect they're not as numerically significant as some people say. I think freedom. I think it's important to have freedom of speech on campus, including people saying difficult, even terrible things, as long as it's not outright incitement to violence. And I don't think the rights of Palestinian demonstrators, I certainly don't think that the people who call me a terrible colonizer, call Israeli settler colonizers. I don't think they should be suppressed. On the contrary, I'd be very happy to debate and discuss and to be open with those people whenever I could. But we, of course, have less of that this day. But of course, it's very difficult when you have such a sensitive issue that affects communities and affects the Jewish community and the Muslim community and other diasporic communities living on campuses and in other places. How do you sort of maintain people's freedom of speech and also maintain communal harmony is tricky. And I don't have the answers for that.
And so what's next? Where do we start from here? Mm. What's your vision of the foreseeable future?
My vision, or my vision, what I would like to see happen, or what's going to actually happen?
No, you said you're a realist, so I can ask you about your vision without being too.
Oh, I'll combine that. I'm pessimistic. I'm pessimistic because, as I said, the two. A friend asked me what would I say to international observers. Right. I would say how to actually sort of improve the situation. I'll get to that. But first of all, I'm pessimistic because rejectionist forces in Israeli society are strong. After October 7th, the support for a Palestinian state would be very low, because the obvious reason is people. We saw what happened in South Lebanon, and we saw what happened in Gaza, and it would be even more suicidal to do that in the West Bank. Palestinian support for Hamas is still fairly strong, although interestingly, it's lower in Gaza, we think, than in the West Bank. And for those reasons, the fundamental problem at the heart of the conflict is not being substantially addressed. That fundamental problem of recognizing that there are two peoples with different stories and different relationships to the land, but who both should have a sort of national collective rights in the land, that principle is not accepted by both parties. And unless it is accepted, then nothing would work. It would only be a recipe for further disaster. And that's why all the mantras about a two-state solution are sort of fairly pointless at this juncture. And the more immediate question is the foreseeable future. The war is still going on. The hostages are still in captivity.
Are there still in captivity?
Over 100, we think, although I suspect that more of them, I think probably some of those would probably sadly already be dead. The question is, the IDF says it needs until the end of 2024. There's still a question about Hezbollah, okay? Because we've been saying this whole time, if Hezbollah and Israel have a full-on war now, it will make Gaza look like child's play. I would say, to a certain extent, although that's not inevitable as well. There's the question of the Houthis, and I see no easy way out of any of this. If we were to get Sinwar tomorrow, then that would obviously be that sort of symbolic symbol, Mohammed Day. If that would be a symbolic victory, but I don't know to what extent it would actually change the fundamental dynamic. And then there's the question of what's going to happen the day after. And this is where the Israeli government has been absolutely terrible, in my opinion, because it has basically given up on, it's lost international support because of an inability to put forward a vision for the day after that is realistic and positive for the future. In other words, it talks a lot about denazification, but without talking about the Marshall Plan. You know, it's the carrot and the stick, because the idea that we're going to be able to sort of remove the population, that we're going to ethnic cleanse Gaza, or the Gazans are going to leave, that is not real. That is not that is undesirable and unrealistic. And we are fated to live To live alongside the people in Gaza and the people in the West Bank. So the realistic option is to think, how can we make things better? You know, my politics at heart is don't antagonize people unless you absolutely have to. And the current Israeli government often does the reverse. And I'm hopeful we'll be rid of them sooner rather than later. I certainly think that if someone like Benny Gantz were to become prime minister, then I think he would be more realistic on this score. But I really have no idea what will happen. And the question of rebuilding, you know, the Emirates and the Saudis and the Qataris, no one wants to get involved in rebuilding unless there's some actual hope that there can be stability in the coming years and decades. And that can only be provided by a clear plan for the day after.
Speaking about stability, one of the takes I heard, and I found it a really plausible claim, is that one of the reasons that the attack of Hamas happened now was that there were actually extensive interactions between Israel and Saudi Arabia for a bigger picture peace situation in the whole Middle East. So that makes, in a way, on a very morbid level, the attack of Hamas also an existential crisis-motivated attack.
Right. So
how is your view on that?
So in recent years, of course, Israel signed the Abraham Accords with the United Arab Emirates and with Bahrain and with the Moroccans and I think Sudan. It was all part of the broader accords, and the big talk, but the big one, were the Saudis, and this was Netanyahu's theory. He said, "We don't." Contrary to the earlier idea, was that whereby peace with the Palestinians comes through peace with the Arab states. It's the actually, first we could do peace with the Arab states and then we can deal with the Palestinians, or by then it just won't matter. And the Abraham Accords, he used the Abraham Accords to try to prove this thesis, but October 7th blew it up in his face. In other words, October 7th showed that the Palestinian issue is still alive and kicking. I do think one of the reasons Hamas probably carried out the attack was to try to disrupt the negotiations to a Saudi-Israeli normalization agreement. I don't think they will necessarily be successful in the long term, for the simple reason that it's in Saudis' interest to come to some sort of normalization agreement with Israel for a host of reasons that exist irrespective of what Hamas did. But yeah, I definitely think, given the optics, given the increased hatred of Israel in the Arab world post October 7th, it will be harder one way or another.
And isn't that, on the long term, the key to solving the conflict? To aim for long term peaceful Middle East.
I mean, that's the easy part. I mean the easy part is to say that the solution is to solve the conflict in the Middle East, or solve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. The much harder thing, and it's why it's proved so elusive for decades or over 100 years, depending how you want to count it, is because the positions of the parties involved seem so irreconcilable. And no one has managed to square the circle. And the truth is, the reason I'm not optimistic is because, you know, many conflicts aren't actually solved by peace agreements. It's not that, like, you know, often conflicts are solved by war, you know. And it may be, if I were a betting person, I would say that war ultimately is more likely than peace to solve the conflict one way or another. But I think, again, for the sake of us all, it would be better to try, no matter what the circumstances, no matter what the excuses, to always be trying to seek a reconciliation in the sense of reconciling opposing positions.
And is that why you are pessimistic?
That is why I'm pessimistic.
Because war in itself is a very a dreadful foreseeable future.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Even if, you know, even if I think that war is the correct course of action right now, which I do, doesn't mean I think it's like this great thing to be celebrated. It doesn't bring me joy. It doesn't bring anyone any joy. We have this is something that, by the way, is a very Jewish idea. There's this faith. There's a midrash, a sort of commentary on the Torah, sort of a story coming out of the Torah about when the children of Israel crossed the Red Sea, you know, the parting of the Red Sea, and then afterwards the Egyptians come in and are killed, and then they sort of do a song in celebration, and God says to them, "Why are you celebrating? These are my creation. You know, these are my creation. Why are you celebrating?" Which is a reminder that, like, even if you are fighting in an existential and necessary war, which is what we think, and I hope I've laid out to your viewers why that is the case, that doesn't mean we should like celebrate or revel in the suffering of those on the opposing side. And it's also why we should try, where possible, to mitigate that suffering through greater efforts to bring in humanitarian aid, et cetera, even if it will, in a certain extent, strengthen Hamas. But doing the opposite, in my opinion, would strengthen Hamas far greater, because it would increase the pressure on Israel.
Yeah. How is life in Israel right now?
Right.
For you as a father of young kids, is it doable? Are you frightened? How do you manage?
Right. So first of all, I was in the north of Israel on October the 7th with my group, and that was deeply traumatic for me, dealing with that and also dealing with my tourists and getting them out of the country. And the immediate sort of days and weeks were very tense in Jerusalem, and schools were cancelled, and that was difficult. It's also difficult because I have family members and friends called up to the army. With time, Jerusalem has returned to normal, I would say, or close to normal. There are many more guns on the street now. I'm glad that we've been able to have that normality, although for me personally, I've once again lost my profession. I lost it during Corona, and now I've lost it again. But I've got other things. You know, I translate and edit, and now I want to do more teaching and writing and things over the coming year. So that's been difficult. But in terms of, I think life in Jerusalem is very doable despite everything. You know, I said to Dan, you know, I always say, you know, compared to Holland, by every objective indicator, Holland wins over Israel, apart from maybe the weather in winter, by almost every objective quality of life indicator. But the subjective stuff, the stuff in the kishkas, as we say, I wouldn't want to be anywhere else. And that's all the more so since October 7th. That, by the way, is one of the interesting things. One of the people who have the settler colonialist idea of Israel think we're sort of fake, and we're sort of like the French in Algeria, or like you just prod us enough and we'll leave. But what was interesting, the opposite. Israel's population temporarily increased by, I think, 3% after October 7th. People coming back to take part in the war effort in various ways. It really brought us together in a way. And by the way, the Palestinians have a word for this in Arabic, samud, steadfastness, to define their attitude to the land. What they need to also, we need to realize that they have samud, but they also need to realize that we have samud, and we're both sort of equally stubborn in our attachment to the place.
It was really great meeting you in real life and talking about all these things. So I really like your I really appreciate that you took the time, and and I really admire your passion, and you're like a verbal machine gun of information, and it's really great to have you in the show and to hear from you. So thank you very much.
It's a pleasure. And as I kind of asked the first question to myself, so I'm gonna ask the last question.
Yeah.
If I had to a sort of parting sort of catchphrase that to sort of resonate, it would be the people of forever are not afraid.